William and the Love Test. William had, not for the first time, become deeply interested in the love affairs of his sister Ethel. Ethel was a young lady of unusual attractions, and her love affairs were naturally, therefore, of a somewhat kaleidoscopic nature. Her present most fervent admirers were two youths who had only recently come to the neighbourhood, which was why William, bored by the local brand of Ethel's admirers, had suddenly become interested. The names of the new admirers were Richard and Charles, and they were both important figures at the local tennis club. Richard was large and muscular, and wore the air of a strong, silent man, when he happened to be silent, which was very seldom. Charles was tall and lithe, with carefully cherished side whiskers. They subjected Ethel to a ceaseless rain of chocolates and flowers, a process of which Ethel, inured to it as she was, could never grow weary. They seemed to run a neck-and-neck race for her favour, and Jimmy Moore, her chronic local admirer, was completely ousted. William rather liked Jimmy, but Jimmy had long since passed the stage of considering it necessary to propitiate William by occasional half-crowns. Richard and Charles were still at the stage of slipping an occasional coin into William's hand and looking at him through something of the glamour that hung about the beloved.
"Such a dear little boy,"
murmured Charles, caressing his side whiskers.
"Ah, nice little fellow, isn't he?"
said Richard heartily. William made the most of this state of affairs, aware that it never lasted long. Excitement rose high, however, among those interested in the situation, when the day of the tennis club annual tournament drew near. For there was to be a dance in the evening, and both Charles and Richard had asked Ethel to attend the dance as his partner. Ethel, with an adroitness of which she was past mistress, put off the final decision.
"Is it to be me, or that ass with fungus on his cheeks?" demanded Richard belligerently.
"You're coming with me, aren't you?" said Charles. "Richard can't dance for nuts, you know. Those fat men never can. If you go with him, I'll blow my brains out."
But as Richard had said that he would drown himself if she went with Charles, this left the situation exactly where it was before. When Ethel repeated to each the tragic threat of the other, Charles said that Richard was too fat to sink, and Richard said that Charles hadn't any brains to blow out. William's attitude was strictly impartial. Each of them had slipped a half-crown into his hand, but even to William their faith in his influence over Ethel seemed a little pathetic. Jimmy, too, had asked Ethel to go to the dance as his partner, but Ethel was so used to Jimmy that she hadn't even considered it necessary to answer his letter. And he hadn't given William a half-crown, or even a half-penny, so that William, too, ruled him completely out of the situation. As a situation, it was, from Ethel's point of view, eminently satisfactory. But the decision could not be put off indefinitely.
"Well, darling," said Doris Clark, her girlfriend of the moment, "which are you going to the dance with?"
Doris, being temporarily without a love affair of her own, was passionately interested in Ethel's. Ethel drew her perfect brows together and sighed.
"I really don't know," she said. "I simply can't make up my mind."
William was in the room, listening.
"Have a test between 'em, Ethel," he said. Ethel, who'd not realised that he was there, looked at him coldly.
"Who asked you to chip in?" she said, and added, yielding to her curiosity, "What sort of a test?"
"Pretend you've lost all your money," he suggested, "and see which of 'em sticks to you."
"Don't be silly," she said, curtly. "I haven't any money to lose. Only 3 and 6, anyway. And in any case, we don't want your opinion, thanks very much, so you can clear out and not sit listening to conversations that aren't meant for you."
William went from the room with slow dignity, wondering, not for the first time, what people saw in Ethel. But despite Ethel's pretended scorn, the thought of a test rather intrigued her.
"I think I will try to think of a test," she said after the door had shut on William's reluctant form.
She decided to send each of them a note on the day of the tournament, saying that she had a headache and asking each to come and sit with her instead of playing in the tournament. For she knew that to each of them, the winning of the men's singles championship was the summit of his earthly ambitions. And therefore,
Ethel reasoned, it would be a real test of love to give up this cherished chance of glory in order to sit with her and soothe her presumably aching brow. Doris thought this was an excellent idea. Oh, yes, it's a really romantic idea, she said. I mean, it's really romantic. Well, I mean, whichever does it must really love you. I mean, really love you. Doris was a well-intentioned girl, but she seemed to think that no statement was complete until it had been repeated several times in the same or different words. You see, she went on earnestly, well, what I mean to say is that if they'd give up the chance of the championship, well, it shows, doesn't it? I mean, they wouldn't do it unless they loved you, would they? I mean, it does prove they love you, doesn't it? I mean, if they give up a chance like that, it shows they love you better than a chance like that. And, well, it does show that they love you, doesn't it? You see,
yes, yes, interrupted Ethel. Now, let's think about the letters. The letters, when finally written, were short and to the purpose. Dear Richard, the other, of course, was Dear Charles, I have rather a headache this afternoon, and I'm not coming to the tournament, so would like you to come and keep me company. Don't bother to send an answer, but if you aren't here by 3, I shall know you aren't coming. Yours, Ethel Brown.
Oh, I'd say a bit more than that. I would, really, pleaded Doris.
No, said Ethel shortly. I don't want them to know it's a test, and you must promise not to breathe a word to William. Doris kept her promise, but as it happened, William did find out about it. Rummaging on Ethel's desk for some paper to make into a paper boat, he came across the 2 notes. At first it merely seemed odd to him that Ethel had written to both of them. Then the still odder fact struck him that the notes were dated for a week ahead, the day of the tournament. Then, suddenly, he understood. It was the test.
And what a rotten test. He could have thought of something much better than that with his eyes shut. He had indeed thought of something much better. He knew, however, that it would be useless to suggest it to Ethel. He must keep it to himself and have it ready in case of need. Considering that the test was his idea in the first place, he thought that Ethel might have consulted him about it. However, he'd be generous and still help her. The day of the tournament arrived. The notes were sent. Ethel sat in the drawing room trying to maintain an expression of suffering. It was nearly 3 now, and neither suitor had come yet. But she had purposely sent the notes late so that they would have no chance of communicating with each other. In order to reach the Browns' house, William knew that each suitor would take the short cut that took him across a safe but narrow bridge spanning a lake that had originally been a quarry, but was now disused and full of water. William stood on the bridge with a hat of Ethel's concealed beneath his jacket. He stood at a point from which he could see the field path by which the suitor or suitors must come. And suddenly he saw them both striding along in silence, side by side, neck to neck, their faces stern and grim. Each had set out immediately on receiving the note. They had met on the way without greeting, and without resorting to the indignity of running, each was trying to outpace the other. Suddenly, with a quick movement of his arm, William threw Ethel's hat down from the bridge into the water, then stood there waving his arms wildly and shouting, "Help!" to the oncoming youths. They quickened their pace to a run. "Hi!" shouted William, pointing to the hat. "Ethel's fallen into the lake!" That would be a test, all right. He'd see which dived in to save her. Even if they both dived in, he'd see which dived in first. As one man, they flung off their coats and dived in from the parapet of the bridge. Side by side they dived, without an inch to choose between them. "Bother them!" thought William. Well, anyway, he would see which went on longest trying to save her. They rose to the surface as one man. Together they shouted, "Where did she go in?" William once more pointed vaguely to the water. "There," he said, "somewhere about where her hat is." They dived and redived. They searched the ledges of the quarry under the water. They arose, dripping every now and then, to shout questions at William. At last, they climbed out at the further side of the lake and sat, panting and dripping, on an otherwise inaccessible stone ledge, too exhausted even to shout at William. And then a strange and unexpected sight met their gaze. Across the bridge came Ethel, dainty and immaculate, accompanied by Jimmy Moore. She had waited till after 3 o'clock, and then had decided with much chagrin that both her suitors had failed in the test. At any rate, she thought angrily, she wasn't going to sit there waiting for them any longer. It was just when she'd come to that decision that Jimmy Moore had arrived to ask if she would come to the tournament with him. He'd already written to this effect and, as usual, had received no answer. But he had a fund of quiet persistence that made him not quite so negligible a rival as Richard and Charles had believed.
"Oh, yes, I'd love to," said Ethel, smiling on him sweetly. "I'll put on my hat and come at once."
She didn't want those wretches to think she'd been waiting for them. Her anger had made her eyes very bright, and her cheeks were pink, and she looked extremely pretty.
"I say, where are Richard and Charles?"
Jimmy had said, as Ethel searched vainly for her hat.
"Richard and Charles?"
said Ethel, as if puzzled, then as if remembering suddenly something so unimportant that she'd almost forgotten it.
Oh, those two, no, I've really no idea. Playing in the tournament, I suppose. I'm afraid I'm not in the least interested."
She shot him her ravishing smile.
"Are you?"
He grinned at her. "You bet your life I'm not," he said. And so they'd come to the bridge, where they found William leaning over the parapet, staring fixedly at the water.
"What are you looking at?"
said Jimmy.
"I thought I saw trout," said William, knowing that Jimmy, as a fisherman, would be interested. For a moment, the three of them, William, Jimmy, and Ethel, stood looking down into the water. All the while, William was acutely aware of the two dripping, panting figures on the far side of the lake behind them, speechless with water and indignation, gazing in wild amazement at their three backs. As long as he could keep the attention of Ethel and Jimmy concentrated on the side of the bridge away from those two furious figures, the awkward moment might still be tided over.
"Come along," said Ethel. "We shall be late."
"May I come with you, Ethel?"
said William with an air of disarming meekness. If he was with Ethel, the vengeance that those dripping figures represented would at any rate be postponed.
"Oh, all right," sighed Ethel, without much enthusiasm. They moved on, William still pointing out the mythical trout every now and then, in order to keep Ethel's head turned away from her still speechless rescuers. Just as they were about to pass out of sight, William glanced back. Richard and Charles still sat side by side on the ledge, two human rivulets gasping out water and fury and bewilderment and threats of vengeance to come. He edged nearer to his unconscious defenders. "Oh, well," he said, uttering his thoughts aloud, "it doesn't matter. And anyway, it was a jolly good test, even if it didn't quite work."
"What on earth are you talking about, William?" said Ethel impatiently.
"Oh, nothing," replied William.